Who are we missing here? Nobody.
Do you want to do a roll call, Bill, just to check?
Yeah, just one second. She's having some recording problems, Tom is, and she's trying to fix those problems.
And I think she just did, Bill. I think it just officially said they have started to record.
All right, let me go back and start over again. Okay, this is December.
That sounds good.
This is December 20th, 2019. It is at the hour of 11:30. It's a meeting, properly noticed meeting of the Governance Committee of the Arizona Historical Society. It's being held in at the Arizona Heritage Center in Tempe, Arizona. And let's have a roll call here. Let's just give me your names. Start out with Bruce. Bruce Gwynn. Bruce Gwynn is here. Linda Whitaker is here. Lynn Marcius is here. And William Garbarino is here. And I think we're being properly recorded. Let's call the meeting to order and get started here. Is there any member of the public out there that has anything to say or any input? And if so, would you please identify yourselves for the record?
There being, no.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I just now got the recording to start.
Linda?
Yes. Tom, it might have started even earlier. I heard maybe about a minute ago saying the recording has started.
Let's start.
Probably lucky for everybody else for not doing it, so.
All right. I did ask if there was anybody here. I can't remember where I left off. Is there anybody here from the public that has any input or any comments they'd like to make? If not, we'll proceed with the regular agenda. Doesn't appear there is. We do have a quorum. Okay, let's start out with the minutes of the last meeting. They were recorded, and I think we have had a board of directors meeting since that time. I don't know that we need to approve them, but does anybody have anything they'd like to add to the minutes of the last meeting of the Governance Committee? And serve state and local historical organizations. We have a policy that's been submitted. Have you all got that policy? Has anybody not got it? Let's put it that way.
Well, so this is the one that was sent a couple, 3 weeks back or something?
Yes, and what it was a policy more or less setting out what needs to be, what is acceptable for a first for it to be a properly certified local historical organization.
Bill, would it be helpful if I summarize for you?
Yes.
If what?
Would it be helpful if I summarize very quickly what the two main points are?
Yeah, because no, I responded to one change that was out there, and I can't remember whether I saw that one or not. So just, I guess, a summary would be great.
Okay. The 2 points are that we're going to clarify for the museums and create a institutional membership. So this is one of the major points of confusion. In the past, we had what we called we required membership at an affiliate level. Well, there really wasn't such a thing as being an affiliate member. So what we want to do is create this institutional membership level, but which is a requirement as a minimum membership level to be certified. They can be a member at any other level because, in fact, we do have quite a few certified museums who do have membership at higher levels, but we want to require this, which is the $50 membership at this time, to be institutional members at the very least. That's the minimum requirement in order to be certified. So that's the first change. Second one is the creation of a two-tier certified program. And the primary reason for that is we had a lot of museums who were really serving an important purpose in their respective communities for history, but they weren't able to meet the requirements of primarily the one that was really tripping off was the number of hours open. But yet, you know, they did serve a really important purpose in their community. So we're creating a two-tier program. One, tier one are closer to what we've had in the past. It requires a higher number of hours to be open, collections management. It's all in that matrix that was provided. And then the lower tier has a lower requirement for number of hours open. It also doesn't require that they have a membership program, doesn't require that they have collections, because many of them, many of the smaller ones don't actually have collections. They take things on loan for their exhibits or do programming. Mm-hmm. And then the primary difference in terms of benefit is that a tier one would be eligible for a $2,000 grant. A tier two would be eligible for a $1,000 grant. So that, those are the primary things that we're looking for here.
Tom, I'm sorry.
I recall, I'm not looking at the paperwork, but I recall from past discussions where we got into, should we have a, you know, a nonprofit or IRS thing, various other features to consider. There was a position in, where it fits here, I don't know, but for historical societies as such. In other words, here's a historical society, it is a society that has members, and it has museums that are scattered around, but so there are historical societies that are just that, they're not museums.
Right.
In
right.
some place in my recollection, there was a spot for that, which would obviate the question of how, you know, how often are you open? So is that concept still floating around? I know it was not that common, but I believe the language permitted it. John Lacey may remember more, but so that's my comment or question, however it is.
Yes, so the these revised requirements do include an opportunity for historical organizations to become certified, but again, they have to demonstrate that they are serving a an important role in the community in preserving and sharing Arizona history. And many times, But
I didn't hear you. I didn't hear you say that at all. You could have, for example, Reenactor Society for history of X, Y, or Z. Or I'm making that up. I mean, so
sure.
But I didn't hear you recite that in your criteria. So.
Yeah.
They're fine. I'm not going to debate it.
Tom, just help me understand. Does this new language smooth out either some of those misunderstandings or the ability to achieve the criteria for these groups? And has this does this also reflect their input?
Yes, yes. So this new structure was created as a result of the focus group sessions that we conducted this past summer. So we consolidated all of that feedback, and then part of that is a result of, or this is a result of part of that feedback.
Got it.
So one of the biggest issues was this confusion over what is required as far as a membership and how do I buy it, and I don't understand it, and they were very confused. And the other part was, you know, well, look, we don't have a collection, but here are the things that we're doing in our community. And so previously they wouldn't have qualified, but we felt like it was really important to include them in the scope of this certified program.
Absolutely essential. I just thank you for that. I just wanted to make sure that was part of the record, that this reflected input from the interested parties.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Does anybody have any other questions of Tom?
I have a question on the scope of what we're considering today. Are we considering exclusively the file that we received, which was the Janice Bryson proposal, which has two bullets with respect to the Community Outreach Committee and certification of local historical organizations, and has a table which defines Tier 1 and Tier 2 qualifications. Is that what we're considering specifically today?
I think attached to your agenda was a memorandum from Janice. It set forth board policies and showed the amendment and put into a form on page 2 and 3 that pretty much clarified what it was to be.
That's correct. And I have it before me. It's a series of strikeouts in section 8.6 of the board policies under Community Outreach Committee and certification of local historical organizations. It has two bullets regarding the committee's responsibility to nominate, responsibility for evaluating, and then it has a table attached which has the qualifications listed for Tier 1 and Tier 2 organizations. The reason I'm asking my question is that Tuan described some other issues that were discussed, like the cost for becoming an organization under this policy. But the only thing I have in hand is that document from Janice Bryson. And it has what I have just described. Two bullets and a table for Tier 1 and Tier 2 qualifications. Is that specifically what we are covering today?
As far as I'm concerned, yes, it is. I have nothing that, about the cost of that was described.
There were some comments that Tuan just made that went beyond this, and I just want to make sure that those are comments that we're not considering anything other than this document today.
So, Lynn, let me clarify. I think the first document that she distributed had it in the table that you're referring to, AHS report, item 1A, that was an abbreviated description. In the secondary document that went out, additional clarification was added to insert the information about the institutional membership. And there's no dollar amount that is in there. That was added for your, just for your information. But it is basically saying, to create an affiliate membership to enable our certified organizations to participate and then be eligible for certification.
Okay. Tom, will that cost be made public then? Should this document be approved as written? Is that going to be part of the, put on the website, for instance?
Yes, it would be, yeah. And the only reason it's not included here is, you know, we always get into issues with if we say it's a $50 investment for this here, if that were to ever change in the future, then it would require a policy change and all that. So, but yes, it would be posted on the website and distributed by our normal communications means to all of the historical organizations that we work with.
Should one statement be inserted then about cost to be determined and posted on the website, something at a blanket kind of statement that may answer the cost question?
It could be. And we can put what we, you know, the $50 minimum, or maybe the idea is that it is equivalent to a basic membership level.
I'm suggesting, Tom, that just a one-liner that says the cost for Tier 1 or Tier 2 or whatever will be determined, I don't know, annually and posted on the website.
Okay.
Just something blanketed. Does that close, Lynn? Does that answer that or not?
Personally, I don't care. I just wanted to make sure that the document we have in front of us is the document that we are considering and nothing else. I want to make sure I'm not missing anything.
No, it was my intent why have this added to the agenda that we're considering the amendment to and the addition to 8.6 of the board policies. That's
my only question is a follow on to what Linda just mentioned is, does it make sense to have that kind of a statement, the one that Linda just suggested, as part of the policy, or should we leave that aside? Our question is, who determines the fee? Is that the responsibility of the outreach committee? Is that the responsibility of the board? Is that the responsibility of the staff?
I would think it would be the responsibility of the outreach committee, and that they would inform staff. Staff would come back to us, and we would approve that amount as the board of directors.
Okay.
How do you feel?
If that's the case, then I think Linda's suggestion has merit.
I do too.
So,
just for the record, the last thing I have officially, I just looked at my file in July, so I just got a note from Tom that tomorrow we're having a conference call. That's all I. But I'm okay with that. I'm listening to the exact, you know, what the process is. But somehow, of course, I'm sort of an outlier on the group here, so apparently I've slipped off the mailing list somehow. So anyway, but what I'm hearing is all fine with me. I just make that comment. I seem to be getting the update. So.
Yeah. Richard, you're off the mailing list? I don't think so.
No, you were
I'm not saying I'm officially off of it. It's just that I have no record of receiving anything with the exception of Tom's message yesterday, which is tomorrow we're having a conference call. Here's the Zoom number, period. So I said, well, it's kind of short notice, but I'll jump in. So for whatever reason, it's cyber thieves or mailing or whatever, I'm just making that. You know, be nice to spend some catch-up stuff.
Yeah. Did you receive my follow-up message where I re-forwarded all of the documents?
No.
Okay.
Well, unless you sent it last night or something. I haven't read this morning stuff.
Oh. You were on the original email, and then when I got your email, I resent all of the documents that were included with the agenda.
Oh, well, you may have, and I haven't got up yesterday afternoon and this morning. I haven't caught up. So that could well be, if that's the case, fine. And I'm hearing everything, and it sounds good to me. I'll just review it from what you sent, so that's fine.
Okay, do we have, is there any more discussion relative to the amendments and additions to 8.6 of our policy? If not, is there a motion to accept this and present it to the boards for a policy change?
I so moved with the added provision that we have that one kind of blanket statement about, you know, a cost of these memberships are reviewed annually and approved by the board or whatever.
Okay.
Second. That's Bruce.
Any opposed? There being no objection to it, we'll present 8.6, the amendments and the addendum to it in the box form that was submitted to us for approval to the board. I think that the attachment was prepared by you, Tom, and James.
I was, yes.
All right.
So, Bill, I can make that recommended modification to this table for presentation to the board.
You mean about the amount of the membership?
Yeah, about in the annual review.
My only problem with that would be that every year they're going to change that, probably, or every couple of years. And let me disconnect this other phone real quick. I can't stand ringing phones.
We're not going to put an amount in there, are we, Tom?
No.
We are not doing that.
No.
But I think every year, whenever it should be changed, it'll come back to the board for approval.
Yes. That's how that that sentence should read. So, no amount other than it's reviewable, subject to approval by the board.
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
Okay, the next item on the agenda, let's see here, were the recommendations related to the 1107 funds. John Lacey, I think you have a copy of John's recent proposal relative to that. Am I correct?
Yes.
I'll have to pull it up here on my little iPad, my pad.
I have two. I have the John Lacey memo and also his fund recommendation email to Voight Coy.
Okay, and is there some discussion on it, Lynn?
Well, I don't know what it says, so just give me a quick brief.
Tom, do you have it there in front of you?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Why don't you read it?
So the letter itself is fairly lengthy.
Summarize.
Basically, his suggestion is that the 1107 fund concept has outlived its usefulness, and we could probably eliminate it altogether, and instead encourage members, if they so desire, to direct additional contributions to either the 501c3s held by the various chapters or to the Friends of the Arizona Historical Society. He's making commentary about this gives greater flexibility for the chapters to earmark specific donations. It talks about the fact that these 1107 funds, makes a number of comments about the fact that the 1107 fund concept is outdated, that it was created during a time where it seemed to make sense then. It no longer does. I think that summarizes it. He basically says it's outlived its usefulness, and it has created a situation where we've got a significant amount of funds that are sitting in these repositories designated for each chapter where when at the same time the organization as a whole is in need of more money to operate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that's been with us for many years, decades maybe. It originated from the issue of the museum board member tasks, duties, authorities, responsibilities, and said, well, then if they had some amount of a budget raised from people in their universe, like staff unit, et cetera, then they would have the authority and so forth. So that was the theory at the time, and I don't have an opinion if it has or hasn't outlived its usefulness. I haven't been on the board for 3 or 4 years, but if the associated, the nonprofits associated with the museums and so forth can fill in that function and, you know, make everybody happy, I think it's fine, so. But that's the history. It did have a purpose at the time. That was a purpose, and maybe it has outlived it, but that's some background.
One of its points, too, is that at the time this was created, there weren't all these individual 501c3s, which now exist and can serve to accept and manage those donations that are specifically earmarked for the various regions.
Well, you mentioned that there was an accumulation of these funds. How much is actually accumulated in the 1107 funds account for each chapter?
Off the top of my head, I don't know, but I think it's in the range of 80-some thousand dollars.
Quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
80,000. Yeah. I thought it was related primarily to the membership. Well, maybe it is. The membership dues, if you said, what's your contributor, you're a member, you know, like staff, for example, you're attached to, you know, the Flagstaff Museum Pioneer, and it's amazing if it's that much money. Well, of course, if it's accumulated a long time, I don't know, maybe there's other funds that go in there, but my recollection is 1107 is a function of membership fees at whatever level, you know, whatever level would go into people from that universe. That money went to that place to spend, so that people drumming up business members in Yuma or whatever would have that benefit. So, well, whatever the number is, it doesn't really change the substance of the point, but it's interesting.
Don? Bob?
Yes.
I have a spreadsheet that I think came out of the November 22nd Finance Committee meeting, which I missed, but I know that you were in.
Yes.
And I think Bruce Gwynn was in it as well, if I look at the minutes. Now, this spreadsheet has a total for chapter membership 1107 funds of $28,352. $50 for Eastern, roughly $10,000 for Central, $2,700 for Northern, $2,300 for Rio, Colorado, and not quite $13,000 for Southern. Now, that's for fiscal year 19. There are also four-year totals here, and there's a three-year rolling average for fiscal year 16 through 18 and 17 through 19. The four-year totals are obviously much higher, but the fiscal year 19 numbers are as I gave them to you just now.
Right. And maybe the number I'm coming up with is more of a like a cumulative over the course of the year, because I know that Central has spent some funds, and so my apologies for speaking out of turn here, but
no problem.
I think funds raised and funds on hand, that's all.
19 funds on hand would be an incomplete year. The previous year, the total was 36,000, and the totals were slightly different, but that's kind of the ballpark for anybody interested.
This is a huge and important departure. I think it is long overdue, and I think Lacey has outlined a kind of a path forward. Having said that, tell me what kind of a storm this will create in the local groups, and are we prepared to deal with that? And can we demonstrate or even project on numbers where maybe those numbers would actually, since they're not going to be dependent on membership, that the amounts may potentially increase? Can we make that argument? Or not?
Yes, I certainly think we can. We have a dedicated outreach coordinator now who I think has a strategy that will help to grow the membership, so that in obviously would result in increased membership dues.
But that's generally, that membership business maybe attached 1107 funds, but that 1107 fund, if I understand this correctly, would now become a centrally managed fund.
Yes.
And so, let's talk about the political implications here, apart from the financial ones, and how this can be better understood and accepted by the local groups.
Okay, here, Linda, let me pose something, make it more difficult. Number one, most of the membership buys are held on a chapter basis, as far as I know.
Yes.
And these chapters go out, and they try to raise members for AHS locally. They have better contact, good contact with their communities. They raise the funds with the anticipation that these funds are going to come back to their chapter. I don't think you're going to find that NASS and the other 501c3s out there that support the Arizona Historic Society are going to be so apt, so wild about soliciting memberships, if they know the funds are going into a general account managed by the Arizona Historic Society in a central location. I can tell you right now that NASS will just say, heck with you guys. We're not going to go out and solicit members for you, and we don't get the benefit of the funds.
And so my point is, given the alternative proposed here, other donations, other kinds of things that occur would remain local. So if there's fundraising around the cabin up in Flag or the Brown House down in Tucson, that money would stay local. Or maybe it's already local. Can you clarify?
No, it is local.
It is.
It is local. If it goes into the nonprofit, it already is local. So.
NAMS has a habit, has a routine of saying, hey, look, and this is coming from NAMS. We're going to raise money for the cabin. We're going to raise money for our local chapter, and we're going to dedicate it to a certain project at that museum. And we're not going to raise it for general purposes unless AHS comes to us and has a dire need for it. The funds that they raise, they intend to be spent here in Flagstaff. And I'm assuming it's the same in Yuma and Tucson. And I don't know much about Central anymore.
So here's my question. AHS's general need for money is also reflected in the regional group's need for money. Why is this large carryover? Shouldn't that be expended by the end of the year? I mean, why is there a significant carryover? These funds, in theory, should be then, if we understand the logic of this, then be expended locally. Why the carryover? Why that large amount? I don't understand. If local groups have a need and the money is there, why isn't it being expended? What's the holdup?
What I see, Linda, is that most of the local support groups are really upset, and you can buy this, reject it, or do whatever you want with AHS. They don't want it to go into the general fund. So they're just sitting on the money. And I think that, I don't know about the other chapters, but I think that's what happens up here. They have decided that they're going to allocate their funds only for projects they want.
But this has come up with the Sunset Review as well. They looked at that carryover. They looked at that money. And one of the reasons that it caught their attention, remember, we got cross-examined about the function, the utility of the both the chapter boards and the local support groups. And that carryover was a question. It came up. And I'm not sure we had an explanation for it, but if the real reason is fear that it will somehow go to the organization as a whole, a reviewer suggested, you have to do something with that money, or maybe it should go to the general fund. So, one of the reasons we have this, I think, wasn't it to protect it from being swept, or am I wrong about this?
That's why we have friends.
That's it?
Friends, the 1107 doesn't help that.
Okay.
But because it's still within the house of the government house, if you will. But if it's in the nonprofit, it does.
So if let me just, for argument's sake, because there hasn't been real, there have been clear feelings about it, no doubt about it. But to outside reviewers, it looks peculiar that they're hanging on to this. Is there, maybe Bruce, you can answer this.
Yeah.
Is there, what would prevent 1107 funds going directly to France?
Let me explain it the best way I can from my own experience. Personally, I don't know where we can spend that money. I've asked, and I've been told, and it doesn't stick in my brain very well, where we can spend that money. So, and we have our own money. So when we need to spend money, we just pull that. And when Yana asks us for a little help doing this or that, we do that. She may know where that money can be spent, but I don't have a clear understanding of what it can be spent for. So it's like having a piggy bank that you haven't seen in a while and just laying back. forget about it.
So I can tell you the concept when it was originated was that the board and the executive director together can spend it on obviously public purpose, obviously a museum. But it's relatively discretionary not for, well, you know, there's obviously exceptions. But basically the board, the whole point was that the board and the director get together and say, you know, we'd like to put new curtains up or, I don't know, whatever. That's, so it's not narrowly limited to, you can only spend it on landscaping or on this and stuff up. So that's the basics. Now, it's probably not well understood, but if we eliminate it, the other thing is if you had leftovers, you could have the central board, central fund, spend it, but spend it on behalf of good things for Pioneer Museum or good things for Yale or whatever. And you could still keep the direction, or the flow of the direction, but it would be part of a central decision for what Yale needs and what Yale itself decides it needs. I mean, I'm not arguing for or against that. It's just
I think it would be helpful if somebody would come down to one of our board meetings and just talk about that. It would be very helpful. And I don't mean that cynically. I just mean that we never thought about it before. I've known the money's been there. I've had Yana ask for us for money to trim the trees. And I said, don't they have money for that up there? And maybe she was saving it for something else. I don't know. So it'd be nice to have a full explanation of it, just like you did. So that's when we spend it on. And then we can plan for it and use it as
Instead of
doing
it as a surplus. No one knows what to do with it.
May I have a comment?
Sure.
I think one of the other fundamental issues here is that the 1107 funds are created from the memberships that are sold. But we have a membership coordinator whose salary must be paid from the membership. And essentially, I think you saw in the other board documents that we aren't covering the cost of membership and publications through our current level of membership revenue. And yet we're not covering it, and yet we're distributing this money to the various chapters where the money's sitting there and not doing any good. While we have expenses related to the generation of the membership revenues. Because there are costs with not only salaries, we've got brochures that we print, we have mailings that we do, we have the cost of mailing the journal, producing the journal. All of those things that are associated with membership that have to be paid, and those monies that would go to offset those costs instead are being funneled to the chapters and not being used.
Well, what we're talking about is policy number 9, and that's the citizen policy. And it's pretty plain. There are 4 parts to it, and it provides for how the funds shall be distributed. I think John says that this provision is no longer necessary, it's outdated, and we should do away with it. What Todd is saying is basically that they're holding up funds that should be used for the membership director, the general membership director, if I'm correct, and that these funds are then going into these various accounts. I think those various accounts have accumulated quite a bit. I think where the problem comes from is just not what we have accumulated today, it's what we're going to accumulate in the future, and I think your membership, sales of memberships and solicitation of new members is going to be fundamentally hurt by if we do away with the 1107 funds as it presently exists. This provision.
I understand what you're saying. What I would throw out there is, until recently, I didn't see a lot of individual membership sales coming out of the various members or various chapters. Now, Northern is doing a pretty heavy push, and we've seen some results up there. But, I mean, this policy has been in place for a long time, and it hasn't proven itself to be an incentive for local membership sales.
Well,
I guess
with the problem with your support groups is who should be soliciting new members, because they don't want to work with AHS.
So this is an underlying a political problem that has been there actually a long time.
Yes.
And that discontent and that distrust and so forth has been there a long time. And this bears a lot of other kind of additional discussion beyond this committee. I'm not sure we can reach a conclusion without maybe more input. But let's just say that the majority of board members end up approving the concept behind Lacey's letter and memo. My question then is, are we prepared to deal whatever the outcome is? Because we have a lot of changes here, and it isn't all just generated by the current director or by the leadership, but these are changes that are reflective of the changes in the environment over time, and because questions have been asked about it. Outsiders have asked the same question, and we've never really answered it very well. So this is sort of search your gut or your conscience sort of thing. And you know, what are the power dynamics here?
I'll make one more comment, and I'm going to shut up off this. Your contact, your general membership is going to come from the chapters. It's going to come from the communities. If you have a centrally located membership director in Phoenix, it's not going to get it done. You need people from your local chapters to go out and solicit members and to gain the support for your local museums. If you do away with that, good luck to the state of Arizona or Arizona Historic Society centrally, because they're not going to be able to get those members. No more.
If I may comment, I don't disagree with you, Bill, but if a centrally designated person that you have now would come, you know, which she did the other day, which I appreciated, and actually had a marketing plan that we could put in place to actively start doing things. You know, we'd all like to be marketers, but we're not. And so to fully understand the where that money goes, and it And like I said, previous to James, I wasn't sure where the dollars and under. We didn't get very much. Anything over 55 we got. So we were encouraging people to spend $100 on memberships. But now you say that we don't have enough money to publish the book, so maybe there's not enough being held back to do those things. I just think it's pretty complicated, and I'm jumping around here. But
hey,
if we had help with marketing,
Bruce keeps cutting out, so I'm only hearing a portion of his comments. Does anybody else have that?
Yes.
Me too.
Sorry about that. They just came to the meeting the other day. They probably didn't do a very good job. But anyway, I think if we had better information, we could sell better down here, and maybe that's the job of that person at Central to help us understand what this thing is.
There definitely is a need for getting that person out on the road and visiting every group or chapter boards plus, you know, support groups or whatever. And Tom, I have a question for you. Is she strong enough to do this?
Oh, yes, she is.
Okay.
Yeah, and she's, like Bruce said, she already made a trip to Yuma. She's been at Flagstaff. She's been to Tucson, and she will continue to have those meetings and reach out to talk with support groups and chapters to work together with them. She's really, really a strong.
Okay. What is the feedback then, Bill, based on what you know, what you're saying? Do these comments come then after this person's visit?
Well, the comments I have are you know, within the last 30 days, but they're not real recent.
And
the what is her name, Tom, so I can address it?
Shelly Correll.
Shelly, when she was here, number one, it's the first person that's ever come down here that really did introduce himself as a membership person and gave me a feeling that she might be able to help us. We've never had that before in all the years I've been here. So that was encouraging in itself. And so I think she can help us.
If I might interject an observation, listening to everyone, having read the various documents, it's all well and good that we have a person on board that we can motivate and hopefully give appropriate tools to allow her to be productive in terms of membership recruitment. But based on everything I have heard and everything I have read, we have three issues with this, and I think that's why it appears so complicated to us. We have an economic issue, we have a political/diplomatic issue, and we have an equity issue, which I would submit is an issue we have not yet discussed. The economic issue is very simple. If I go to Policy 9, which Judge Garbarino has recommended, it states the first $40 of all membership levels will be used by the administration to fund the Journal of Arizona History and membership services. We know that $40 is not adequate. And so we have some alternatives. One is to eliminate or reduce the amount of time that is spent on membership services and or reduce the amount of money that we invest in the production of the Journal of Arizona History. Okay. So we're talking about downsizing. If this were a corporation, we would be talking about whether or not we really need a membership services coordinator, whether that position should be eliminated, and those responsibilities should be absorbed by a current member of the staff. Or we might be debating whether or not we need to downsize the Journal of Arizona History and downsize the amount of money that we invest in the glossy nature of that publication. The second issue we have is political and diplomatic, and it stems from the economic issue. In the best of all possible worlds, what we would do is we would calculate what it takes to have a membership services coordinator and to have a Journal of Arizona History as we have it today. And then what we would say from an economic perspective is, you know what, the first $40 aren't hacking it, so it's going to be the first $60 or $70 or $80 of membership that will go to the support of the journal and membership services. And if there's anything left over, that will go to the 1107 buckets. Now, that takes us to the political and diplomatic side of this. We have local chapters who have essentially been led down the path of believing that these funds are theirs. And since they put the sweat equity in order to collect these funds, one can't blame them for having that particular view. They have been allowed to have this view for an extended period of time, and it's now become part of our institutional culture. That gets to Linda's observation that we're going to play heck with trying to change the rules here, even though economically it makes sense to do so. The third issue we have is an equity issue, and it may not be a major issue, but it is an issue, and it's an issue that I would present to those who believe that they own the 1107 funds. Mm-hmm. And it is this. I am a member of the Arizona Historical Society. I pay my $65 a year for a family membership. My $65 membership with all of your memberships, whatever level they are not sufficient to subsidize the Journal of Arizona History. Now, somewhere in my neighborhood, there's somebody who is not a member of the Arizona Historical Society, does not receive the journal, could care less whether or not the society has a membership services person. But the production of the Journal of Arizona History and the salary of this membership and benefits of this membership services person is being paid by that non-member who is an Arizona taxpayer. And that's an equity issue. Now, we might be talking of mills on the penny to any particular taxpayer. Nevertheless, what we are doing by using funds that are not membership funds to make up the difference in the publication of the Journal of Arizona History and salarying a membership services coordinator is we are using state funds for something that was intended to be supported by membership funds. There's your dilemma.
Well, Len, just as a comment, unless it's changed, the Journal of Arizona History is a statutory requirement.
You are correct.
Okay, so then that is a state statute requirement, state funds being used for that is certainly not without propriety. On the other hand, our policy of let's have our members support it is perfectly reasonable, and so I just make that comment that of your corporate punch list there, eliminating the journal or making it a couple pages is probably not an option unless all of the rules change. So that's my only comment.
I agree. That's why it's a dilemma.
Yeah, okay.
But I don't want to lose sight of the equity issue because...
I don't disagree with any of that. If one of the options is not to eliminate or down, and I think even if there was an option, I think if you eliminate that as a factor in our universe, it's probably the strongest, most credible product if you had to just pick one, you know, that we have. So it would be unwise even if it wasn't a statutory requirement, which it is. So, anyway.
I have a question for Richard and for Bill. I just want to make sure my understanding is okay. The 1107 funds and the disposition of them, it was a board decision way back when, correct? And not part of state statute.
No. It's purely a...
Purely board.
As I mentioned, it was a politics in quotes, because of the authority, the jurisdiction of the board, each museum board, are they advisors or are they just kind of go along, get alongs, or they do something? And that was an effort to say, well, if you make a decision that you need to, you know, repair your doors and locks, and then here's some money that we use. The central office may not think that's the most important. If you do, fine, you spend it with the money that you have. That was the whole thing. Good, bad, or indifferent is what we're debating now, but that was the whole point.
You know, I think it was adopted, the present policy was adopted in 1999. It was reviewed again last year when we adopted our new policies. And it is a policy because it is easy for the board to amend the policy. And
yeah, for sure.
Anything that deals with money, you know, membership fees or any other kind of fees, that input fees, is something that the board needs to be able to review easily. And that's why it's a policy. And I think this is something we can review easily. I have no suggestions on how we proceed from here. I'm not sure that setting the amounts is for us to do. I think that may be a strictly a board policy, and we have no recommendation there. What do you think, Lynn? I think Lynn's observations are really good. What do you think we should, how do you think we should proceed from here, Lynn? Lynn?
I'm obviously, like everyone else on this call, deep in thought about how we work our way out of this situation. My first comment would be, if I go back to the November 22nd meeting of the Finance Committee, which, again, I missed, and so I would rely more on Bruce Wynn, who was at the meeting, and Tom, who was at the meeting, to elucidate. But the critical paragraph in the minutes from that meeting is this. In summary, the committee is in favor of discontinuing the chapter funds program and recommending that funds be directed locally through the Friends of AHS to the individual chapter 501c3 subsidiaries. Existing chapter funds should remain where they are, and the chapters should be allowed to spend those dollars for their specific needs until they are gone. Bruce recommended that the organization look at a new membership model that will satisfy the need to fund both membership services and the journal. He suggested that we need a better understanding of who our current members are, what they want, and what the potential membership is looking for. Along with this, the organization should also take a close look at the costs of the journal to determine ways we can reduce costs and create a more user-friendly look. It was also recommended that the organization needs to define the role of the chapters. And goes on to expand on that. But that is, in summary, what appeared in the committee minutes. Subsequent to that meeting, Tom Rose was contacted, and he expressed the opinion that the 1107 program should continue because it provides an incentive for the chapter to recruit members. And Kelly Corsett did not feel, Kelly Corsett, who was contacted after the meeting, did not feel that the 1107 funding program provided an incentive to the central chapter, and felt that a more efficient and effective membership model that was centrally driven should be explored. That's what came out of that meeting. Now, my question organizationally is, this is a committee recommendation, I would assume, but where does it go? It wasn't part of our packet, so clearly it didn't come to us. But this is the sense of the finance committee.
Do you know, Bill, if this is going to be, that report is going to be part of the January meeting? Because that's very important.
No, I don't think this is an action item for us. This is a discussion item for us to discuss. I mean, to put our feelings out there, and I think eventually whatever comes in from the other board, from the other committees, we'll try to put into some type of order and submit it to the board in general.
Yeah, well, the issue of it certainly is a governance and policy issue as opposed to a finance committee issue. Now, certainly the finance committee say we could get some more money if we did this or that, and that's our report. Fair enough. But changing the policy to achieve those recommendations for the finances, dead center on a governance and policy committee for whatever that's worth, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Richard, I think the policy committee, the governance committee there is to take policies submitted by other members of the board and other committees and put it into a workable fashion and submit it to the board of directors at the next meeting.
Well, I'm agreeing with that. I mean, we can generate our own comments as well. But certainly the whole policy issues submitted or recommended by whomever are passed through, like, you know, congressional stuff passed through this committee to say is formulate a policy and make sure it doesn't conflict with other policies. So there was some, I had the inference that the finance committee could make, they can, the board has the power, but can just say, let's change the income for all the chapters, any questions, and do it. It really should go through the committee, this committee, whether we agree with the finances or not, is a separate issue. So that's my only comment.
That's good. I agree.
Glenn, just refresh my memory. Was there, and this is based on our last board meeting, no, maybe it was an executive committee meeting. I don't recall, but was there a special task group within there to look at the 1107 funds for finance? Am I wrong about that? Were they tasked with developing this further, exploring this further?
I think this may have been why the November 22nd meeting of the Finance Committee was held.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce, do you recall?
I think Meredith was tasked.
Yes.
To make it understandable for the rest of us and to explore this and see what can be done.
So we are awaiting actually more information from that committee group. Correct? Is that it? We're still waiting on more information? Or is there work done regarding this?
I don't think it's done. It's definitely not done, just with the conversation today. But I think it didn't come to a conclusion what we should do. I mean, I made recommendation that we need to come up with a new membership model that is more understandable. Obviously, the $40 is not enough. How do we cover that? And those sort of things is the reason for my statement. But it's obvious that our problem is we don't have enough members, and we need more members, and it would take care of all those issues. So, you know, how we get there, I'm not sure. But I do know that we have to prime the pump and give it a try, and that's through that membership lady is the way I feel about that.
Hey, Tom, has either Shelley or you made some projections about how many more memberships it would take to cover these expenses?
Well, right as of the last fiscal year, we were at 100, again, and I don't have the documents in front of me, I apologize, but I believe 100 and near 110% of the membership, I've got it backwards here. Basically, our expenses were 110% approximately of the revenues. So I haven't put that into actual number of memberships or anything like that, but yeah.
Why can't we put it to the president of the society to put together his committee, or he already has a committee, and let them make a recommendation to the governance committee so that we can put it in form and submit to the board of directors.
I'll second that.
I agree. That's a great idea. We've got to figure this out. Somebody has to.
Yeah, at this point, unless there's documentation out there that I don't have, we have a recommendation or a suggestion from John Lacey and a email copy of a communication from Lacey to President Coy. We do not have the minutes from the Finance Committee meeting. I have them and Bruce has them by virtue of the fact that we're on that committee, but they have not been forwarded in any way with any call to action to the Governance Committee.
Hmm.
So at this point, we can discuss this issue, but we have no one placing a policy before us for consideration.
I think Tom Rose has also submitted some on his own, has submitted to us his proposal for an amendment to the bylaws.
That's correct.
And that should be in consideration too. So why don't I just, via the Governance Committee report, put it to the president of the society that to get his stuff together and get his committees lined up. And give us some work with.
Formal motion, get your stuff together.
I think, you know, there's a lot of information that's sort of pending out there. I think, Todd, it also calls for some sort of formal presentation of the marketing plan by Shelley. I think board members are going to be interested that this, if there are questions from them, questions on behalf of their own constituencies, we want a face, we want someone to go to, and let's see how she sells this plan to the board generally.
Mm-hmm. And if she would take that 110% and come up with a membership figure that would take care of, that would give us a goal to go after all of it.
Well, the other thing is, Tom, and maybe Bruce on behalf of friends, I thought that the publication committee, am I wrong on this, or the advisory committee already, it continuously looks at expenses and that kind of thing. Do they have any kind of a fundraising role?
The friends?
No, the committee, or I don't know if it's an advisory group or the publications committee. I know they look at finances regarding publications all the time, and I'm just wondering, do they have ideas, or have they ever discussed a plan about how to better fund the journal, and why is it pegged to membership? Maybe it gets pegged to something else. I don't know. That membership designation was entirely a board creation. And maybe we're looking at this from the wrong end, but I'm interested in hearing what the publication committee has to say about any of this.
Okay.
We have information coming from various groups, and it needs to be heard and collated before I think next steps can even be drawn up.
Okay, let's take this 1107 fund issue and put it back on the president of the association and let him come up with some recommendations. I don't think we have enough to work with, nor do I think we have everyone's ideas.
Correct.
Do we all agree on that?
Yeah, I think it's completely correct.
All right. Yes. I'll write up a neat little governance committee report and put it on somebody else's shoulders.
But I think that, and you know, Bill, I mean, that's just politically wise. You already know that this committee has kind of been a dumping ground for some very difficult issues. And when they're this complex, with this kind of history and this dissension, it needs to rise above just our work. And I think it places that responsibility where it ought to be.
I agree with you, Linda. And now while I've got you on the stage, tell us about your amendment to the policy relative to veterans.
Well, okay, first of all, this is a confession. First of all, this is a screw-up. This is my screw-up. Because I was on the task force.
Oh, screw-ups.
I was on the task force to look for old policies and so forth. I completely missed this because it was never in the manual. It was never codified in that way. It was buried in the minutes of a board meeting. And but you should know this is no less contentious than any of the previous discussions we had, because I also, you can blame me for this, I helped a board member write this. It's only like a one or two liner originally in terms of a veteran's policy, admission policy. And my intent was that this would be to active military, because there is ready proof. They would have ID. Currently, this reads that any veteran qualifies, and because most veterans don't carry their discharge papers or whatever around with them, It is based on just self-reporting. Yep, I'm a veteran, and I should be admitted, et cetera. It does not extend to families, never extended to families. My question to this group is twofold. One, because the service demographics has changed dramatically. And once the Vietnam-era cohorts die, This is going to be a much smaller part of the population generally. And so that's one thing. It's a changing dynamic. Number two is, and this is based on conversations I've had with James and with Tom, we have lost on average about $15,000 a year based on this blanket policies that all veterans get free admission. And if you are a discharged veteran, you're not, it's words if you just take somebody's word for it and move on. So my question is, and you can see then how this has been implemented across the organization in terms of, you know, what's on the website currently, what are the charges currently, you know, one says, you know, ask about free admission for veterans. That's a nice blanket coverage, but currently it's just all comers. So, in light of our finances, in light of, it just depends on, I don't know how this is handled at the front desk exactly, but if they declare themselves a veteran, they will get in with no proof whatsoever. I did not, I did some commentary here, but this is how it's been implemented at the time. And it was not adopted by the board unanimously. There was a disagreement and certainly objections from the staff, but we've now had this in place long enough we know what the loss in revenue is admitting, you know, all veterans, active, inactive, et cetera. My question to you is this time to limit it to active because there's proof that may decrease our loss in terms of what we're experiencing by the blanket policy, or just keep it as is?
Bruce, what do you think?
I think it should be, I don't know, I think limited to active veterans, active military. That's my thoughts.
Richard?
Well, you could limit it. The only footnote I'm a veteran also. And you're right, I don't carry around my papers, but I could, DD-214, but would be retired. Retired military always have a card because they go to the Air Force base and, you know, shop and all that stuff. But that's even a smaller cohort, but I don't have a really strong opinion either way, but if it's 15,000 and you can assume, which you can't necessarily, but if you can assume that they would come if they had to pay versus they wouldn't come if they had to pay, you know, that's always an issue. But just say half of that, even 7,000, 8,000, it's, you know, it's significant and I shouldn't deter. So you said active and retired. That's usually how it goes, active and retired, although except if you're getting on an airplane, then it's active in uniform. So that's all I would add.
I think active and retired, that the retired certainly connotes, you know, 20 years plus serving in the military, and I think that is certainly worth noting. We don't have it in there. This is the time that we can change it. Tom, just tell me, because we have asked about our free admissions for veterans, that's a nice blanket thing without committing, you know, more information, but what if we limited it just to active and to retired?
Okay.
And go ahead.
I'm good with that.
So you know, I have a problem with the whole thing because I think that most people act in good faith. I don't think maybe there's a few liars out there and cheaters, but I think my experience has been that most people act in good faith. If you let a veteran through the door, if he says he's a veteran, he's usually going to have his family with him, and he's going to be, and the more people we can put through those doors, the better off we are. The family pays, even though the veteran may not. But I think if they come to the door and they say, I'm an active member or I'm a retired member and they have their family with them, let them through. But that's just me. I'd go with the rest of it if you disagree.
Well, no, I think the issue of the proof of if you're active or retired is not a big deal. If I said I'm not, every day I was an active armed forces member, I had my card on me just like a driver's license, so that 100% and most of the retired do. So the policy, as far as are you a veteran, I agree with you, Bill, that the great majority, a high 90% of, won't make it up just so they could go to the museum. I think it's true. Now that's a policy question. Let's say everybody that was served had a card. How does that affect the policy? So it's really the policy of letting anybody that served in or not, not whether they're believed. That's a sub part of the question. And I don't have a strong opinion. And the other part is, as you point out, Bill, if I go because I'm free and I bring my wife and two kids or whatever. So it would be interesting to see if there's a data point on that somehow, just anecdotally, if you research the front desk of the places. When a veteran comes in on average and says he's a veteran, is he alone and goes in there by himself, or does he bring a couple of folks to pay? And if we can statistically kind of develop the notion that the guys that do come in and say they're a veteran usually come in with somebody that does pay.
Hey, Tom, you've collected some stats on that. What are your findings?
And which part are you referring to, Linda?
I'm talking about what LASS is, and then how many veterans come in with family, et cetera. Do you have any stats on that?
We don't really have hard data, no. We have anecdotal evidence. We primarily get veterans and not active military in here, and typically it's a couple, a retired couple. We get families during the summer, and it is usually part of the Blue Star program that some of the museums participate in, where we do offer free admission to families as well during that 3 months of the summer. But during the rest of the year, it is consistent across the organization that it is primarily retirees who are veterans, and they are typically with one family member.
Let's go back to, if we could, Linda's suggestion that we extend this program to active duty military personnel and retired veterans. If I go to Ace Hardware and purchase something these days, I get a veteran's discount, but I don't get any free hardware. If I apply for a fishing or hunting license at another state agency called Arizona Game and Fish, I don't get any discounts at all. The only people who get free licenses are active duty military personnel who are serving within the limits of the state of Arizona. If I go to almost any commercial establishment today, I may get a discount, but I will never get a free service or a free product. So from that standpoint, I think we could pursue Linda's recommendation and not feel in any way reluctant or as if we're doing a disservice to our veterans. Most veterans out there, I think, understand what benefits they get in the commercial community and what benefits they get or don't get from state agencies. If I want to go to use state land, I don't get a discount as a veteran. I have to buy a permit from the state land department. So from that perspective, if we recognize veterans who have spent two decades of their lives or more serving our country, and if we recognize military who are on active duty, that, it seems to me, is a hand well extended and a recognition well deserved. And for the rest of us who are veterans and do not carry around DD-214s in our pockets, I think we can live with the fact that when we go to a state venue of any sort, by and large, we're going to be expected to pay for the service or the product that's offered.
Okay. And then the one comment I would add is just as a and no revenue impact really. This last Veterans Day, Applebee's put out a thing that said free breakfast between 9 and 12 at Applebee's for all veterans. So some of my friends said, well, let's try it out, and I went. So they just said, all veterans over here, and you got a free breakfast. Of course, you leave a big tip, and I think the tips were more than the breakfast, I think, when the smoke cleared. But if you had on a Veterans Day, any veteran, you know, it's just a goodwill thing. It's just, and we could do that ad hoc, too. You'd say, come to any museum in the Society for Veterans on Veteran Day. You know, well, that's one time, one out of 365, or not. But it's just to your point, you don't get free hardware at Ace Hardware. I don't even get a discount. But
yeah, let me get personal here. I have led for a number of years on every Veterans Day a hike on behalf of McDowell Sonoran Conservancy for veterans. And my wife and I cover expenses for serving a thank you veterans cake and refreshments at the end of the hike. And from my perspective, we've had veterans join us over the years who've appreciated that small token of being able to go out into the desert with stewards and learn a little bit more about the military history of the McDowells. And they appreciate the little ceremony. We typically have the oldest veteran present and the youngest veteran present repeat the Marine Corps tradition on Marine Corps birthday, where the youngest veteran will cut the first piece of pie or first piece of cake and serve it to the oldest veteran as recognition of that person's service. Things like this are great. They're recognition for services that we'll never be able to make up for truly. But in this case, getting back to Linda's recommendation, as a state agency, I think we're on firm ground if our policy is active duty and retired with identification, are allowed to or are invited to come in free. We're being more generous than many other state agencies in that respect.
I certainly agree with that and support that. Tom, can you confirm the losses? My recollection was $15,000 annually. Is that true?
Tom doesn't appear to be there anymore, Linda.
Okay, good. Well, there you go. But
here's my suggestion. Linda has submitted a policy here to put some closure to this. It says, ask about free admission for veterans. I think we should add for active members of the military. And let's just think what we have and just be glad that Joe Abedili is not on this committee.
Oh, thank God. So listen, this is a policy that would be probably a one-liner, okay? And it would probably read just that, the board has approved, free admission for active and retired military, ID is required, and just leave it at that. And that, you know, it was reviewed, it was approved in 2014, it was reviewed in 2019, blah, blah.
Does everybody agree with that?
Yes.
Yes.
Richard?
Yes, sounds good to me.
And Lynn?
Yes.
There'd be no one opposition to it. Let me if you submit a one-liner to us.
Yep, I will do that.
All right, thank you for that. And in order to get this thing some closure in this meeting, what else do we have? Well, we had a submitted by James and staff, the county policies and procedures manual. And I don't know what we need to do with the updated, the adopted, or what we need to do with it.
Bill, I have an answer for that. Just so you know, this is kind of, I think, rather unique to this organization. I don't know of other state organizations that have incorporated, the state guidelines into the local decisions about how money is spent and so forth. But I can tell you that when this was created through the Sunset Review the last time around, they really liked it. And so if there were any shortcomings, we could refer to that. It was an easy reference tool for the surveyors. So all we have to do is just accept it as submitted.
Do we adopt it as a part of our policy?
No, I mean, because this is staff.
Okay.
I mean, generally this regulates staff.
All right, everybody's had a copy of it. Does anybody have any disagreement with the suggestion?
I don't have a copy, but I don't have a disagreement either. So.
Okay, Bruce?
I don't have a disagreement.
Len?
Nope. This was just by way of additional background. This is something that Linda and I insisted on being produced as part of making sure that we have appropriate documentation for the upcoming Sunset audit. So that's the primary purpose for the existence of this document.
Okay, is there anything anybody else wants to present as a part of this meeting? Not here.
I'm going to adjourn.
You know, this has been a good meeting, and I appreciate your attendance. We've got something done. We'll get it, put it in shape, and get it for the board, set for the board. Anything else?
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Have a good
one. Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Adios.
Adjourned at 101.
I'm out of here. I don't know how to get out.
I'll end the meeting for you, Bill, in just a second.
All right. Thank you.
Have a good one. Merry Christmas.
Bye-bye.